Welcome to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig and my co-host Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there,
this
folks.
Is a pre-recorded version of the show because isolation.
Yeah, coronavirus.
The station is closed, so we would love to hear from you, but we can't. So please don't call. I guess the way we're going to start is a press release from the Harris County Clerk that they will be closed. The main office annexes to the public on the advice of county leadership as a measure to help contain and mitigate the spread of the coronavirus. This is basically the bulk of the announcement. The closure will take effect starting last Wednesday, March 18th. Today is, we're recording this on the morning of the 23rd, and will continue until further notice. Employees will continue serving the public by email and phone, but residents are reminded they can access most services online. Among these are electronic filing of real estate, electronic filing in the courts and personal records. Electronic filing for campaign and personal finance is also available online. The Harris County Clerk's Office is currently working on a plan to continue making voting accessible for the upcoming elections. If you want to reach the County Clerk's Office, it's www.cclerk.hctx.net. There is a runoff election that was originally scheduled for May, but that is now tentatively rescheduled for sometime, perhaps in June, the date to be determined. The City of Friendswood sent out a press release on March 19th that elections within the city will be postponed. That also includes the Friendswood ISD bond election. I will be posting contact and link information if you want to go to my website when that's up there. I'll try to have that up before this show airs. As always, make sure you're registered to vote. HarrisVotes.com is still working. VoteTexas.gov is still working. All that information, all that stuff is still working. And you can go to the announcements yourself. Getting to some of the apropos articles that I think we're going to address here. There are two or three stories we're going to get to, and then I want to get to what I and Andrew both agree is kind of the central discussion that we're going to approach. So the first story is entitled, "We Were on Borrowed Time, Coronavirus Could Strike Final Blow to Local Newspapers." This is from TheGuardian.com. It says, "A number of West Coast papers have suspended publication as ad revenue from local events and businesses plummets." Now, this is one of those things that people in the industry would have clearly anticipated.
Oh, absolutely.
That lay people like us may not have been top of mind. But in an industry that's already struggling, could this be a death knell? So the way the story runs, it says several local newspapers on the West Coast announced that they are being forced to suspend publication perhaps indefinitely. Jeff Von Kniel, I think the name is, the president of the Sacramento, Chico, and Reno News and Reviews, three small alternative weekly papers in California, Nevada, announced that the economic impact of the corona pandemic could be the end of the organizations. Almost the entire staff has been at least temporarily laid off. Print editions will cease to be published for now. And he said in a statement, the drastic move came because of a steep drop in ad revenue from local events and businesses after many cities closed non-essential businesses, including movie theaters, etc. The quote that he gave, which I think is pretty well sums it up, he says, "I'm a pretty good salesperson, but to try and place ads for events that aren't happening is beyond my abilities."
Yeah.
So this could be, for many newspapers, the end of their current business model and perhaps their business.
Yeah. And it's, you know, when people talk about, you know, the death of print media, you know, I've always thought that, you know, sure, some of the bigger newspapers and some of the smaller newspapers could end up shutting their doors just, you know, as online media, video media, those sorts of things become more popular. But I've always thought it's a sort of movies versus theater situation, in that there's a different experience, you know, between the different forms of media. And that's why somebody might choose a newspaper over getting their news online, even though it's supposedly less convenient, even though it takes longer to get the news. There's still something different about having a newspaper in your hand. The problem is that this is a totally different issue. This isn't about, you know, people's choices. This isn't about, you know, what people prefer. This is about necessity. In order to avoid spreading disease, they're just not going out and doing things as much. Well, and so that means there's less advertising.
Yeah, I think the way to sum it up is essentially what he said, that when there is nothing to advertise, there's no advertising to sell.
Yeah. And so, like, it brings up the question of, you know, is the media industry in general doing enough to prepare for potential, you know, health emergencies like the coronavirus, like any number of other, you know, pandemics that or potential pandemics in the past, you know, and I know that
Python said nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Sure. And, you know, they're ready to report on stuff, and that's important. But I don't know if I think they may have focused too much in my totally, you know, pedestrian analysis. They may have focused too much on being able to report on the news rather than protect themselves from, you know, things that could negatively affect them.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, you need people to collect news.
Yeah.
And that costs money.
Yeah.
You know, whether they're working at home or working in a central office, people have to make a living.
Yeah.
And the question is, assuming that we value reporting, journalism, actual journalism, where it's primarily facts with as little bias as possible, then there has to be a business model developed that will sustain that. Now, whether that's turning reporting into a nonprofit industry or whether it's an all-digital industry so that they don't have to worry about paper and presses and printing and ink and the mechanics of delivering a physical document someplace.
Right.
There's going to have to be a business model. And if it turns out that it's something that is a national security necessity, it may also be, as nonprofits, something that is partially subsidized by grants from the government. The government will essentially support the journalists that report on the very same government, whether you like it or not. There has to be out-of-the-box thinking to support the journalism that sustains a democracy, whether it's a representative or a direct democracy.
Yeah, sure.
People that want to be informed need to be able to get informed.
Yeah. And unfortunately, in a system that, you know, prioritizes profit above so many other things, if you don't have profit, you can't do the things that you need to do in order to make, you know, the information available.
Which is why maybe a nonprofit model is the future.
Yeah.
You know, one of the ideas that I've had two ideas actually about this over the years. One, you and I discussed in our sort of pre-chat last night about what I might call the BMI royalty model.
Right.
That you have news aggregation sites that pull pieces of articles or headlines of articles, reporting that has cost money. To my knowledge, they still do not pay those papers anything or those organizations anything to aggregate that news.
Right.
And yet the aggregation of that news pulls eyeballs to their site and allows them to make money their own way through advertising revenue or clicks or whatever. So what you have is a breakdown in the business model where you have a provider doing something that costs money and another business that's taking that business and taking their material. I mean, on its face, it's not right. Now, you have the BMI model where what was eventually worked out was that when music is played in public fora, whether it's a store or a radio station or a movie, or, you know, however it's used, there is a royalty that gets paid. And depending on the situation, either the royalty gets paid directly to the copyright holder, or it goes into a pot where it's portioned out to smaller, less popular bits of music, let's say, so that some form of royalty is paid to somebody or somebodies, no matter how it's played. If a royalty is due, it's collected by BMI or some other organization and then dispersed out.
Yeah.
So I think that that is one way of supporting journalism that is currently essentially being stolen by companies that are very strong about asserting their own copyrights and yet are just stealing this copyrighted material, enough of it, not the whole article. You know, you can argue, what's the term, common use?
Fair use.
Fair use. You can argue fair use, but in this case, we're talking about the businesses making the fair use the business model.
Right.
So that's, I think that's an issue that needs to be sorted out. There has to be a little bit more money flowing around there.
Okay.
I think the second idea that I came up with a number of years ago, but of course I have no way of doing anything about it, is, and now it's less necessary because we have the phones and the tablets that are capable of doing this. But the idea that I had a number of years ago is buy a subscription and get a tablet that you can read the subscription on. Mm. And the tablet is like part of a free gimme that you get with the subscription. Now, that model probably has been made obsolete. I had that idea like at least 10 years ago. But there may be some version of that that may be an inducement to people to subscribe.
Sure.
I'm not going to go into all the possible permutations. There are people out there much smarter and better informed than us. But I think that it's not that journalism is obsolete. I
right.
think the business model for journalism as we've known it is obsolete, and it's a national security issue, literally, to find a model that works to support actual, as unbiased as humanly possible, journalism.
I think,
let me do a station ID before you go. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. I am Mike Koenig. This is a pre-recorded show. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson. Why do I always stumble?
It's all right. It's all right.
I'm going to go with age.
Yeah,
age excuses so much. Yeah. My problem is I'm not a cute old lady, though. I'm just kind of a heavy, overweight old man. Older man. Jose Flores once said I could use the term middle old.
Yes.
Middle so, old. So I'm just going to go with early middle old.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
One thing that, a potential rub in the idea of having this sort of royalty system for news media is that, you know, the news trade essentially does deal in information. And what's really difficult about, you know, trying to prove trying to enforce legality on information is proving that the information that you have in your head, you got from somebody else, you know, or who you got it from, whose information it was before it became yours. And so that's
not only
one
that,
of
but
the,
who generated it, who dug
exactly,
it out, who,
exactly.
who formed and shaped it.
Yeah. And so these are all things that a potential royalty system for news would have to deal with. And honestly, I don't know how it would deal with those things.
They would have to come up with a media organization comparable to BMI or the ABA or, you know, this. I think that there are core organizations that could take on this role, perhaps, but there has to be a way of collecting and meeting out revenue.
Okay.
I think that would go a long way towards supporting journalism that currently in many ways is just being stolen and used by other businesses.
And, of course, we've got to balance the interests of the public as well with that.
Well, precisely. And I would also love to have one place you can subscribe that would give you access to 100 media sites.
So you could
be a subscriber.
Yeah, we'd all like that with the streaming video services we have right now. All like 20 of them
that
individual subscriptions for, and you can't find what you want on any of them half the time.
Well, I think a model might be something like SiriusXM.
Yeah.
Where you can subscribe to 130 radio channels or more, and they are sorted out by music or news or folk or country or adult pop or. So you can really choose, and you are subscribing, and therefore the providers of that music, or in the case of like MSNBC is one of the channels that you can also get on SiriusXM,
Okay.
Talk radio. All of these people get their beaks wet a little bit, as they deserve, because they're generating content that SiriusXM is then selling for a profit. So I think that that's a model that can be looked at in terms of one place you can subscribe and then have access to maybe 100 different journalistic contents. So just
something worth thinking about.
Yeah, it's just kind of my thing. I want to move on because there's a main topic we want to get to, and I want to preface it with these articles. So the next article that sort of also touches on this problem of changing the model of how we do things is an article in what's called communityimpact.com, and in this case, slash Houston, for the city of Houston metro area.
Community Impact Newspaper is the Houston metro area.
Well, communityimpact.com is a community newspaper that essentially it focuses stories on different parts of the community of Metro Houston, Greater Metro Houston, parts of Texas, and wherever else they generated.
Yeah.
In this case, this story is pulled from the Houston edition, even though it's a story that takes place in Pearland. And it's called "We Can Help Them Maintain Normalcy. A Local Music School Adapts Under Coronavirus Concerns and Prioritizes Mental Health." And the excerpt I have: "With concerns over the coronavirus at the forefront of everyone's mind, some business owners have had to make fast changes to slow the virus's spread, or in other cases, to obey essentially quarantine laws that are being put out. One business adapting quickly is the Allegro Pearland Academy of Music, which opened in 2011. It has begun encouraging students to take part in musical composition challenges held twice a month to keep the students motivated." I believe the owner says it was definitely challenging because online lessons weren't something we had as a backup before this, but it's been very rewarding. I've seen that the kids are really happy to be able to see their teachers and continue their lessons. So again, now you've got a situation where the coronavirus, the pandemic, is forcing businesses that you would never expect to be able to do distance learning to try to figure out ways to do distance learning using, I would say, current technology, except current technology doesn't entirely cope with it. So we're talking about taking current technology, tweaking it, advancing it, finding new ways to apply it in order to satisfy this new unanticipated need.
Yeah. And you'll see, or you can see this sort of the limitations of the technology that we have right now, because so many universities across the country are going to online only classes, my own included, although that hasn't started yet in my case. But you know, the date of the start for online classes at my university has been pushed back a couple times. And I suspect it is because they are still trying to figure out how to get everything set up and how to get it all talking to each other in the right way. And so, you know,
because
this
really
sort of,
this has never been designed for this.
Yeah, it's a scale of demand on these technologies that hasn't been, you know, that wasn't envisioned.
And it puts a new burden on students and teachers that they have never in their life had to adapt to.
Absolutely.
So how do you discipline yourself when you're at home instead of in a classroom with all the distractions of home? Some people have a lot more distractions than others. How do you isolate yourself and focus and not reach for the refrigerator, decide to do a crossword puzzle that's in front of you and the teacher can't tell, or, you know, just zone out?
Yeah.
And then the teacher, you know, a teacher is a performer, and I've done community theater, and the audience makes all the difference.
Yeah.
And if you are a serious instructor who isn't just blathering stuff that they've done for the last 20 years just to put in their time, if you actually are interacting with your audience, which is your student lecture hall, say, or your small classroom, you take energy from that, and you create new diversions in your thinking and your lesson plan from that. How do we keep that experience in this new world?
Yeah, it's a difficult question to answer because so many of us haven't had to think about it before.
Exactly.
And, And so it's a perfect opportunity for the companies that already provide these sorts of...
conferencing.
Yeah, this sort of conferencing to, you know, kind of develop their product more to be able to handle this sort of thing. Or it could be a gap in the market for a new type of business.
I think it's going to be both because you have teleconferencing software. I mean, you've got Skype, which is a really basic form of teleconferencing software and what we're using right now.
Yep.
You know, so that's the attribution. But, you know, now we're going to need something more sophisticated. You could argue that corporate teleconferencing software is sophisticated, but apparently it's not been sophisticated enough to stop people flying in airplanes to go to meetings.
Mm.
So now we're talking about a new level of virtual reality, not necessarily right. wearing goggles, or maybe wearing goggles, we don't know yet, where there can be more interactivity, more spontaneity, more ability to communicate in the ways that a personal meeting involves that up till now maybe has not fully translated in terms of a teleconference. And then talking about lecturing in a teleconference way, which is different from meeting in a teleconference way. So I think, as you're saying, I think it's going to be both tweaking and advancing current teleconferencing tech, but also developing new ways to integrate it into new needs and
right.
integrate perhaps technologies that have not been thought of to integrate realistically. And now it's like, well, you know, we're going to have to figure out a way to realistically do this, like
right.
perhaps virtual reality.
Right.
And maybe people will have their avatars and you'll have your screens and you'll all be sitting at a virtual table with your avatars. And if you want to make an obscene gesture to somebody, you'll be wearing a glove that can do it.
Mm.
And
which,
that's
I mean,
the interaction in steroids.
Well, there are a lot of products, mainly in the gaming space, actually, that do come pretty close to that. They, you know, you can put together a virtual avatar and you're in virtual environments in virtual reality. It's just the gloves we don't have yet.
Well, the gloves exist.
Oh.
I mean, those kinds of gloves have been sort of in the tech evolution space for a long time.
Oh, okay.
Because they help the computer understand where your hands are and what they're doing and what shape they're taking.
Right.
So now we're talking about a situation where we might end up with a new synthesis of two technologies that have been evolving in parallel but differently that now may be forced to a merger point in some new and perhaps unanticipated and incredibly superior ways, depending on how you define superior.
Sure. And bringing the entertainment angle into it, let's also talk about the other aspect of this story, is that these composition challenges, you know, are not just about, you know, keeping students, you know, learning new things, but also keeping them engaged and helping parents deal with the challenges of interacting with their family for long stretches of time without leaving the house, you know.
Which goes back to the difference between engagement and distraction.
Sure.
And
sure.
also keeping in mind that the point of these musical compositions and this telelearning is also that at some point they all come back into what amounts to a teleconference in order to demonstrate their compositions, because
right.
there would be no... The educational value, I don't want to say there's no, but the educational value would be limited
yes.
if you could not present it. It's a performing art.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Have to present it. You have to be critiqued. You have to try different ways of arrangement. I mean, it's music.
Yeah.
Music is complex. It's not just one melody or tone.
Yeah.
You know, counterpoints, harmonies, all this stuff, instrumentation. This is all really, really important, and you cannot do it by yourself in a room instructed by a computer screen.
Yeah.
It is an interactive art.
Yeah.
We are now at a point where, let me do another station ID. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. This is pre-recorded, so please do not call. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson. I'm going to get it, man. It's going to get smoother.
It's going to
get smoother.
Yeah.
Just have so many syllables in your name. I don't know. It's just...
Well, you've only
anyway.
Got three, so yeah, that's a strength you have, I guess, that I don't.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have to, like, when I sign my name, I don't have to just write an H with a squiggle.
Mm.
Whereas there are people that have a very long name, and they'll do, like, the first letter and sort of the second letter and then sort of a line.
Yeah, that's exactly what I do.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what people with long first or last names do, which, you know, makes – I guess at that point it's no longer a signature. It's your personal mark.
I guess so.
As if you couldn't sign your name properly, instead of making an X or a fish or a cow or something like that, now this letter with a squiggle that you more or less replicate becomes your mark. I'm just saying, because it's illegible, but let's get back to the point.
Yes.
So there is another group, a bunch of climate activists that use phone banking to urge older Americans to stay home. It's called the Sunrise Movement, and they're going to be using a system originally designed as a way to advocate for Bernie Sanders, and they're going to use it apolitically as a platform to foster community in a time of unprecedented isolation. And the excerpts I've taken from the article, young climate activists are taking to the phones to convince older people that the coronavirus is serious and to provide essential information both to help them stay safe and to slow the spread of the coronavirus. The Sunrise Movement will utilize its own phone banking platform, which organizers used to talk to hundreds of thousands of young voters about Bernie Sanders, whom the group endorsed for the Democratic presidential primary. The phone bankers, however, will not be advocating for a political candidate. They will simply be using this for community, important community information and updating.
Yeah.
So, again, you're talking about a technology and a system and even a political group.
Yeah.
Which was formed and created and honed for one purpose, which is now being readapted, repurposed, I think is the word I'm looking for, which is now being repurposed in order to do an apolitical, community-supportive thing.
And to be honest, something that has been the realm of government in the past, communicating this kind of information to vulnerable populations is something that,
or with journalism,
true. But it's something that the federal government and state governments and local governments, at least the federal government, had more of a hand in before the Trump administration. I'm sorry?
The regime.
And but now it's falling sort of on the shoulders of private citizens who are now going, well, we've got the ability to do what the government isn't doing.
Essentially, the federal government under Trump has kind of written itself off as a central organizer. And in perhaps the really first thing that they have done that Republicans used to claim was their goal is let state and local governments handle this stuff. And, of course, the problem is as a nation, we are a nation of states. The states look to the central government for overall guidance in a crisis. Yeah. So if we were to go to war, you wouldn't let California organize its National Guard and Texas decide whether or not it's going to mobilize its National Guard. You would have a mobilization. And that's what a central government is for. And that's part of what makes a nation a nation.
Yeah.
So they're just kind of AWOL, away without leave. And that's kind of where we are. So,
but what is kind of inspiring or positive about this whole situation is that this is a demonstrator of how effective community organizing can be in order to solve problems when the government has kind of abandoned your community in a sense.
Yeah, let's say if hypothetically Washington was nuked, we now see that there are local leaders that can take the bull by the horns and actually try to make things happen. And in a sense, this is, you know, in terms of the longer term effects of this pandemic, there are people that may have had high profiles that will look not to be great leaders. And there are people that may have had low profiles that all of a sudden will pop out in the public consciousness as being very effective and decisive leaders in a time of crisis. And so we're going to be seeing the effects of this politically in this country for probably at least the next two generations.
Yeah. And, you know, it's part of a sort of broader trend that doesn't get as much attention, I think, of community organizations, people who care about their community, people who care about the people within their communities who are, you know, serving the underserved. You know, you've got organizations like Food Not Bombs comes to mind. They're an organization that advocates for peace by providing food to those who, you know, are homeless or just generally have food insecurity in their communities. And, you know, they provide us a place for people to get the resources they need to survive and to, you know, have a sort of a meeting place, a gathering place. And, you know, there are other, you know, what some people would call direct action organizations like these, and that are community oriented. And it just kind of reinforces to me how important it is to see, you know, if you have some free time, obviously not right now because of the whole stay indoors thing. But if you have,
well, actually that's now what the internet is more than ever for.
True, true. So, you know, even if you can't leave your home, for whatever reason, you can still work with, organizations like the Sunrise Movement in this case, or Food Not Bombs in physical cases to support other people who need support in times of crisis. And that's an important thing to remember.
And actually, that brings me to a wonderful segue. You're listening to KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. This is Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig and my co-host Andrew Ferguson. And I want to point out that you can support KPFT.
You sure can.
By going either to kpft.org and clicking on the donate link and hopefully picking our show as your preferred show to donate to, Think Wing Radio.
In order to do that on the internet, you will have to click the red donate button, not the donate with PayPal button, because donating with PayPal may be simpler, but it doesn't give you the chance to specify a show.
Also, mm-hmm. PayPal is now run by a very right-wing guy, so just use our regular donate button. So, yeah. it used to be Elon Musk as a partner. He was bought out, and now it's run by some other guy who's very right-wing. So, you know, you can avoid – it's kind of like I don't shop Home Depot just because – I don't know if I can say that, but there it is. It's done. They can bleep it. Now, I also want to point out that you can support KPFT by texting. You can text to the call-in number, which, yes, when we are not pre-taped, would be 713-526-5738, and then text the word give, and it will send you a link that will allow you to interactively choose things like what show you're contributing to and how you want to pay for it and whether you want to be credited on the air, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes. So give GIVE to 713-526-5738 in order to.
I will also point out that my website is thinkwingradio.com. I will be posting links and things to what we are discussing and then some. And I think now I want to sort of bring us to our central thesis, if you will.
Sure.
Which is, we've talked about these three other stories and about how the coronavirus pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic, which is requiring social distancing, which is requiring self-isolation, which is now requiring people to try to get things done in ways that may have been peripherally in their consciousness on one hand, may not have been permitted by their employer on the other hand. And now, to the extent that they can do their jobs through telepresence, if the business is going to do any business, they're just going to have to get over this whole not reporting to business thing. There is one thing I want to mention. I ran across an article that you and I had not discussed yesterday. I ran across it this morning. Well, this my morning. And Best Buy is no longer doing delivery in home. And yes, they are no longer doing, I think, starting the 18th of April or something like that, or sooner. They're no longer going to be doing in-home service. They're no longer going to be doing in-home delivery. So now when we're talking door-to-door delivery, that is exactly what it is. So if you're buying something big like a TV, a refrigerator, a window air conditioner, a range, they will bring it to your door.
And then they'll set it down.
Now, they're not even talking about whether they'll unpack it for you. So, like, assuming you have a couple of guys or a couple of big people that are able to maneuver this thing into the house, are you also going to have to unbox it, uncrate it? I mean, I've worked in this industry. There's a lot of unpacking to do.
Yeah.
And then you have a lot of stuff that needs to be picked up. as opposed to carted away by Best Buy to whatever central dumpster compactor they have. This is a big deal. How do you tele-deliver a refrigerator? Or if they will go door to literal door, how will 69-year-old me, or my, if she was still living here, my 82-year-old, 83-year-old mother-in-law, how would she get this refrigerator into the house, or this range, or this air conditioner, or whatever big thing is? You would need to have neighbors or somebody who either has immunity or has protective gear or is willing to get sick or is willing to make you sick to come and bring this stuff in. So all they're really doing is transferring the responsibility for protection, potential illness, potential infecting of others to other places.
Right. Because and the human element is still necessary in order to transfer this stuff, because it's very difficult to get a forklift through the front door of a residential home. So
until we can get a transporter to beam it to the right spot in your house, you know, I would actually think that what Best Buy should be doing, and especially if this goes on for an extended period of time, which will segue into our what are going to be the major societal changes that will end up being created by this, maybe they need to have these guys with reusable personal protection gear.
Possibly.
So that they can deliver it into the house, and it has to be sturdy enough that it won't tear in the delivery and service process. Because this may take longer than we thought. So
here's... Somebody call NASA and ask if they have extra spacesuits, I guess.
You know, you joke.
Yeah.
But this actually kind of brings us to what I think is the central thesis of today's show, which we have maybe 20 minutes for. So we may end up with an after show. We'll have to see. I am reluctant to use this analogy, but I think it's important, but I don't want to create any additional panic, okay? Right. This is not a panic thing. This is just a historical analogy thing. The Black Plague that struck Europe in the mid-14th century, terrible fatality rate, nothing like what we're accustomed to now. I mean, this was a fatality rate of 30 to 50%.
Yes. And nothing
in some
like,
cases, 90, but overall, yes. 30 to 50% of the population of Europe died.
Yes, and nothing like what we're seeing now, by the way, in no way comparable to anything that's going
on.
In
no way comparable to what we know about COVID-19. The fatality rate of COVID-19 is orders of magnitude less.
Yes.
But I think the historical comparison is the unanticipated consequences, the societal changes, the technological changes, the social changes, the health changes, where people actually, the survivors actually got healthier because they were paid more, because labor was scarce, there was more land available to buy and farm, they ended up getting a better diet of fruits and vegetables. So the archaeology that has done analysis of this, the people after the Black Plague receded were actually a healthier population, and it is thought that, in fact, the experience of the Black Plague may have had a role in the beginnings of the Renaissance. Having experienced the theistic attempts to cure and the degree of death where it was hard to grieve because so many people were dying around you constantly that you became numb. And the Renaissance and the Enlightenment very well grew out, at least in part, of the experience of this massive die-off of human beings, not to mention the technology that had to be created in order to do the jobs of all these people that were no longer alive. And there, I have read speculations that one of the reasons, you know, technology, for the most part, had not changed around the world for 500 years or so. I mean, you know, there were tweaks here and there, small advances, but nothing really revolutionary had happened for about 500 years. And now all of a sudden you had thinkers, engineers, entrepreneurs looking for ways to accomplish things that used to be accomplished by many cheap hands that now could only be accomplished by very few expensive hands. So they needed to do it more efficiently. It has been argued by some that it was this historical change that ultimately allowed Europe to obtain the technological advantages, militarily and other technologies, that enabled them to go out and conquer much of the world. Mm-hmm. Now, there may or may not be merit to this, but I think that it brings us back to the situation we confront now, which is we're having to learn how to do things from home.
Yes.
There are arbitrary rules that employers or ourselves have followed or been forced to follow about you have to take your transportation to your workplace, even if your work is on the phone, even if your work can be done remotely. And now all of a sudden it's like, well, okay, I guess you can work from home for the next 2, 3, 4 weeks because otherwise we have to shut down the business. And, you know, much like the saying after the First World War was, how do you get them back down to the farm when they've been to Gay Paris?
Mm.
And how do you get them back to the office when they see that they don't need to be in the office to do this stuff? Why do I have to get dressed above the waist? Why? Yeah, we talked about this. Why can't I wear my shorts, you know, below the camera line? Why do I have to take my car? Mm. Why do I have to put mileage on it or buy gasoline? Why do I have to get up an hour early just so I can commute? Why do I have to take an hour and a half out of my day to be going back and forth to a job that I can do from here?
Mm.
Now, I mean, you take this example, there are numerous examples that then outflow from that. For example, if this one way or another becomes the norm, whether because it's cheaper for business or because workers begin to demand it more, and I realize not every job can be done remotely, but to the extent that many jobs can be partly or wholly done remotely, we'll need fewer cars.
Yeah.
We'll need less fuel, and the cars will need less maintenance. Mm. The roads won't be as crowded. We may have to maintain them, but we may not have to expand them.
Mm.
We may find that if we do more telelearning, that all of a sudden campuses are going to have a whole lot of vacant space to repurpose.
Sure.
So, I mean, and this is just the obvious stuff.
Yes.
So we're talking about what may be right now a potential cusp of human history globally that may end up changing everything.
Mm. Yeah. And, you know, talking specifically about, you know, the aspect of working remotely, you know, I have seen a lot of stories from people on social media who, you know, are disabled in one way or another and have asked to be allowed to work remotely, and their requests have been denied before.
And so, what we're realizing is that could be an arbitrary decision.
Exactly. And, I mean, plenty of them knew it at the time but couldn't prove it or didn't feel like they had the resources or didn't feel like they would win in court or whatever. But now there's resentment coming towards their management, towards their bosses, from this fact that, you know, when they needed it to work from home for their own well-being, they were denied. And now for the well-being of the business, everybody's being allowed to work from home.
And now here's one of those things that may not be immediately obvious, except to people to whom it applies. The Americans with Disabilities Act requires reasonable accommodation for people with disabilities in order to allow them to get a job that they can perform.
Right.
Well, now we get into a whole new thing. It may be more than having a ramp that can get them up in the office or having a handicapped toilet stall. Now it may be, maybe I don't need to actually be there at all, and maybe that's the most reasonable accommodation that you can give me.
Sure.
And now we have actual evidence that we didn't have before.
Mm.
So that becomes a big thing. Let me do a quick, this is, I think, our last station ID. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson. We are community supported, so we really appreciate anything you can afford to give us anytime you can to kpft.org. Click on the donate link. Which color is it?
Red. It is the red donate button.
Red donate link, so you can bypass PayPal and choose a program. Also, you can text to 713-526-5738 with the word give, and it will send you a link, and there's an interactive thing there you can do to donate. In terms of my show, you can go to thinkwingradio.com and see blog posts mostly related to shows I've done and old shows going back to 2010. Most of them have recordings. And also some other articles.
Something to do while you're sitting at home. Because of the coronavirus, you can go back and listen to old episodes of Think Wing.
Before, we talk about a lot of interesting stuff.
Before my beautiful voice was gracing the airwaves.
Or at least your voice.
Okay.
Well, I think I just, I just laughed something onto my screen. Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't think I had anything in my mouth to laugh onto the screen, but, you know, this is live radio at home.
Yes, the perils of working from home.
So, I mean, let's explore this a little further.
Sure.
What's going to happen to the food and beverage industry, for example? Mm. There are a lot of food-centric businesses, restaurants primarily, sit-down restaurants primarily, that are not geared to take out and deliver. Some of them are claiming that they're only a week or two away from solvency, which makes you question the business model. If you're that close to insolvency that you're essentially living, you know, payday to payday as a business. But, you know, now we're talking about what's going to happen when this pandemic passes. And it will. Mm. What will happen? Will these restaurants, some of them perhaps, be able to reopen? Will it be business as usual? You know, the anecdote that I shared with Andrew the other night was, I sometimes observe Jewish traditions. I'm not religious about it, but, you know, traditions.
Sure.
And when I would try to observe Passover, when you're not supposed to have anything that has been leavened, no yeast in bread, you can't have fermented wine, fermented breads.
Okay.
A lot of different rules that, you know, you can observe them to whatever degree you want to observe them. But the interesting thing is, after about 8 or 10 days of that, I would usually break my Passover fast with pizza and beer. That was my thing. And a lot of people I know would do that, because that's like the most fermented stuff you can get. And the weird thing was, after not having been able to have any of that for 8 or 10 days, it actually felt weird to have it. You actually almost felt like maybe you shouldn't. And I think that goes back to some of the changes that will take place as a result of this forced discovery of how we can still accomplish economically valuable stuff without being a place of business.
Yeah, because humans are extremely adaptable creatures. It's one of our greatest evolutionary strengths. And, you know, it means that we can very easily get used to a certain set of rules that we have to live by, whether that's for our own survival or because we just want to, or because we believe that it's you know, it's important.
And it become a preference rather than an obligation.
Exactly. Yeah, and it can definitely become that as well. And so imagine if that happens on a sort of national or global scale because of what goes on, because of the differences in our lives, because of the coronavirus situation.
Now, let's consider a possibility that because people have gotten used, I mean, everyone has done takeout already and everybody has done delivery, but I don't think on the scale and with the frequency that they're going to be doing it now.
Right.
So let's say that people, some segment of the market begins to really like not having to get in the car and drive to the restaurant and maybe wait in the bar until there's a table available. So maybe now restaurants are going to have to develop a new business model, probably with new technologies, not just a better pizza box, but a way of bringing food to a home or bringing it to a car to bring home that will more closely replicate the in-restaurant dining experience. So, for example, there are certain foods that I simply won't have delivered. You know, if I want to have nachos, yeah, I'm not going to have that delivered because by the time they get to me, they're soggy.
Right.
Or if I want to order a prime rib, I'm not going to have that delivered to me because by the time it gets to me, it's cold, the texture has changed. It simply is not an equivalent experience. It's just food.
Yeah.
So what are some entrepreneurs going to do in order to more closely replicate the dining-in experience for the carry-out or delivery experience? Will those new ideas end up being patentable technologies? Will they be something that can be licensed? Will all of a sudden would they become more of a norm throughout the dining industry? Will the business model for the dining industry have to change, the hospitality industry as a whole, that, you know, somehow they're going to have to make enough money that 2 weeks without money is not going to put them out of business, that they're not going to have to hire employees without health insurance or sick pay, that there will somehow be a way to create enough of a profit margin. And maybe that'll require government mandates, so everybody is on the same level playing field, so prices everywhere are reflected what has to happen. That's really what regulations are for. Regulations are to create a floor that everybody can rely on, either in terms of pollution control or safety or features or whatever. And then if somebody wants to give an enhanced experience, they can sell that as an enhanced experience.
Right.
And maybe dine-in is going to have that problem. Hospitality businesses maybe are going to have to look at that.
The possibility of, you know, new developments is something that definitely should be explored. But this could also accelerate trends that are already being seen or that are already present in the industry. You know, you hear about Amazon's drone deliveries of groceries and that sort of thing. But you hear about, you know, driverless cars being fitted with, you know, lock boxes for, you know, pizza delivery and that sort of thing. And, you know, while these aren't things that are, you know, common on the average American residential street yet, you know, you think, well, maybe instead of being the norm in 10 to 12 years, because the market changes, because people get used to this idea of getting food delivered more.
Or simply need it more.
Or simply need it
better. And exactly. Now there's an impetus.
And now there's an impetus. And so instead of 10 to 12 years, it becomes 5 to 6 years or 3 to 4 years before this kind of technology is ready. So I think, you know, there's a number of different trends that you could look at to see if, you know, how might this be affected by people's changing expectations and changing tastes.
And, you know, I have a couple of other examples here, like aircraft and trains and cruises, and, you know, all of these things are going to be affected sometimes in very predictable, catastrophic ways, but then perhaps in new, more creative ways to try to make up. There have been stories about how you have fish and other wildlife returning to the Venice canals because everybody is staying inside. So there are environmental changes, perhaps benefits, that may come from this.
What will be
the psychological impacts?
And in the cases of the environmental impacts, I mean, that's less specifically the Venice aspect. Although I think if we're thinking of a particular Twitter post that went around, those are actually pictures of a different Italian city that has always had fish in those rivers. But it is still a valid.
But there are also other reports that, in fact, the canals do seem to be getting cleaner,
and they are
seeing more life in them, coming back to them.
And that's not necessarily because of the residents of the cities, although, of course, they will play a role. But it could be, I think the majority of that impact is coming from the lack of industry working, you know, because people are all working from home if they can, or they're not coming into the office.
Well, they use motorboats.
Yes, right.
And the motorboats leave oil slicks, and they disturb the water, and, you know, people throw stuff into the canal even though they're not supposed to, because people are people.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like after 9/11, when all the aircraft over the United States were grounded, and it was the first time they could take satellite pictures of the United States, of North America, without contrails.
Mm.
It actually changed the air over the United States because all the planes were grounded. It was a unique research experience.
And that specific example kind of served both of our points, because while airlines are obviously, you know, the planes don't fly if there's not people willing to buy tickets or able to buy tickets, it's also airline is a major industry. And that is, you know,
Which consumes materials and creates jobs.
And has an impact on the environment.
And requires airports.
Sure.
Bigger airports and bigger terminals.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're talking about how much infrastructure will be repurposed, how much infrastructure will be not needed, how much infrastructure will be downsized.
Sure.
You know, once you have a new technology to accomplish things like working from home, it's only a matter of time before that new technology is repurposed to do new and unanticipated things that someone comes up with. It's like, yeah. Oh, that's a pretty cool app, you know, the killer app. Mm. I think we're down to like 2 minutes.
I'd say a minute is probably safer so that we have some time to give people a nice little musical outro.
Yes. Okay. So do you want to wrap up a little?
Anything well, yeah. You say? Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, this is... I mean, even just looking at our show, the fact that we've had to do this remotely, you know, thinking about all the different ways that, you know, the coronavirus situation could impact just human life, or at least life in the
all
U.S.
All life, maybe.
All life. Yeah, honestly. If we wanted to think on that scale, it's not necessarily something to be excited about, I wouldn't say.
No.
But it is certainly an interesting question, and it's one worth asking.
And it gives us optimism at a time where a lot of people are very afraid and feel very, very inconvenienced and fear for their financial and physical security.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, I think we're done.
I think we are.
Do you think we have enough for an after show, or do you think we pretty much covered what we wanted?
You know, I think I've covered everything I wanted to say. I don't know okay. about you.
All right, so let's say if we decide to do an after show, it'll pop up. Otherwise, I think we're cool. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM with my co-host Andrew Ferguson. I'm sorry you weren't able to call in, but I think it's been an interesting show, and hopefully we'll continue doing this for the duration, and you'll have something from us at least once a week.
Sure.
Everybody take care, stay safe, stay healthy. Stay isolated for the time being. Flatten the curve. Remember, there's a shortage of everything. Be well.
See you later.
Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together? And find the place that's safe and warm. It's not too late. We should be giving.
Aloha! In today's complex world, filled with complicated instructions like do this, turn here, don't staple, fold, spindle, tape, or mutilate, one way, etc., etc., why not take a break from all of this? Not near a seashore or relaxing in a tropical paradise. Well, the surf's up over at kpft.org. So mouse on over to kpft.org and pledge and renew online. It's easy, uncomplicated, and will give you that warm and fuzzy feeling of having done something good for yourself and your community. So wax that mouse, hang 10, and surf over to kpft.org and renew your membership and pledge online at kpft.org. Thank you for supporting KPFT Houston, Radio for Peace. Mahalo.